This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Are you looking for a sign? Aren't we all at some point in life? At the American Sign Museum in Camp Washington, you may not find the sign you seek, but you'll certainly have a great time looking. On display throughout a 40,000-square-foot former parachute factory are thousands of signs. And joining us to discuss the American Sign Museum and its 10th anniversary this year are museum founder Todd Swarmstead and WVXU reporter Bill Reinhardt, who is always searching for signs. What are your favorite signs? You can be part of the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Todd and Bill, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Happy to be here.
And me too.
Todd, why did you decide to create a museum solely dedicated to signs?
Well, you have to know a little bit about my background. I actually worked on a trade magazine, a business-to-business magazine on signs. I worked on that magazine about 28 years. The magazine actually goes back to 1906, and my great-grandfather was the editor of the first issue, so it's been our family business for 110 years. I am a collector. If you saw my house, you'd say he's definitely a collector. Not a hoarder, just a collector. Took a lot of history in college. There wasn't a sign museum, so I got the idea one night to start one.
So there are no other sign museums in the United States, just this one?
We're the only sign museum that covers the whole range of American signage. There is a Museum of Neon Art in Los Angeles who we've done some projects with. They happen to be in storage right now. They've got a building in Glendale that they're hoping to remodel. And there is a Neon Museum of Las Vegas, which is just neon signs and just signs of Las Vegas.
But you are the sign museum.
We are the sign museum, yes, sir.
What are all the different varieties of signs that you have at the museum?
Well, obviously, we have neon signs.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorites.
We talk about the history of electric signs is really three periods, the first period being the light bulb period. So we have light bulb signs. Then came neon, so we have neon signs. Then we have plastic, internally illuminated plastic signs, and that's just the electric signs. Then we have painted signs. It might be gold leaf on glass. It might be what we call show cards, which are hand-painted posters. Trade signs, which are signs that are in the shape of a symbol, where the symbol represents a product offered, like a shoe for a shoe store. So all types of signs.
Do you remember the first sign that you collected and got your hands on? Did you just still happen to have that particular sign?
Actually, we don't have that sign. I traded that away. I think I got a good trade in the deal. But it was a welder sign where there was the top half of a welder with his helmet. And he would it was animated where when he would – his animated neon, the neon would – or the torch would touch, and then the light bulbs would all flash. So it kind of looked like an actual welder who was welding.
Some of those old signs are pretty elaborate, aren't they?
They are very elaborate, yes.
Now, why do you think people have a love and a fascination for signs?
I get that question a lot. I think the timing for the museum is fortunate. There's a lot of interest in retro, vintage. If you just think of, I call it roadside Americana. People are interested in Route 66, interested in old diners, old theaters, and then signs are part of that mix. If you think about the interest in things like American Pickers, Antique Roadshow, just all of these things add up to an interest in signs. I think it's also part of that walk down a memory lane. And signs happen to conjure up memories, but they're always good memories.
Bill, where did your love of signs come from? I know it's ghost signs in particular, but how did you get into this kind of thing?
Well, it is definitely a nostalgia thing. I know at the Sign Museum, they've got one of the big old Holiday Inn signs. And the town I grew up in had a Holiday Inn with that. And we came home from vacation or wherever, and that was always the thing you'd see first driving into town with the big green Holiday Inn sign with the arrow leading to a star. And they took those all down across the country years and years and years ago. And so when I saw Todd's Holiday Inn sign at the museum, it's like, whoa, that takes me back about 30 years. So there's definitely a nostalgia to signs. I tend to prefer ghost signs, old faded, painted on the side of building type signs. And I collect pictures of those. I go around wherever I travel. I try and take pictures, and I've got a nice little blog. We did a story on it December, January of this year. And I've just always liked the historic value of those signs. You drive through over the Rhine, particularly downtown, Queens Gates, and well, more Camp Washington than Queens Gate. But you see what used to be there, you know, all these advertisements for businesses that no longer exist, or basically saying this was here and now it's moved on. And so you drive through an area that perhaps is now redeveloped and is all residential, and you see these signs on the sides of buildings, and you think, wow, this used to be a warehouse district, or this used to be a commercial district, and now it's residential. So I just find that fascinating.
Well, how many of these ghost signs are in Cincinnati?
Hundreds. Hundreds. Like I said, you can see a lot of them in Over the Rhine, downtown, Camp Washington. Those are about the three biggest neighborhoods. But just about every neighborhood I've been in, I can usually find at least one somewhere.
What's your favorite of all those, Bill?
Oh, I'm very partial to the Denison Hotel. I'm not sure why, but I do like that one. I think that's one of the first I noticed when I moved
Todd,
to Cincinnati.
Todd knows that.
Yeah. Didn't it say something like 82 rooms, 22 bathrooms,
yes,
or something like
yes.
that?
Yes, there's a disproportionate number of bathrooms to actual sleeping rooms. Over here at along Central Parkway, I'm drawing a blank, the Brighton building.
Mm-hmm.
That great big old warehouse, cold storage building, just covered in ghost signs, and they're layered. And so you can see a little bit of a history right there from when it was this business, and then they painted over that and painted a new sign, and then that faded, and they painted over that. So you can see the progression of how that building has evolved, the usage.
So whenever you travel, Bill, you're always looking for ghost signs.
Yes. Yeah. I'm about to go on vacation, and I'm looking forward to going to Kansas City because I understand there's a lot in Kansas City. I'll be in Omaha, and I've already canvassed Omaha, and they do quite well for ghost signs there.
It's interesting that he talks about the changes in Over the Rhine, because there was a guy just here at the museum, a friend of mine from Brooklyn named Frank Jump, and he has a blog called Fading Ad. And he had documented a lot of these walls in Over the Rhine back in the late 90s, and he came here and he said, what happened to that wall? He was trying to find the walls that he had seen back in the late 90s, and a lot of them were gone, as you said, Bill.
Yeah, a lot of them are just fading over time, and sometimes they get painted over. There's been a couple, I can think of one just off of Race and McMicken. It was a big, colorful ad for vodka, and just in the last 2 years, it was a beautiful piece of, well, I thought it was art. I'm sure some people didn't.
Yes. Yeah.
And that got painted over. So sometimes they get painted over. Sometimes the buildings they're on are torn down. There was one over by Findlay Market. It was a big advertisement for an electronics store, televisions, car radios, that sort of thing, back from the 40s and 50s, I believe. And the building it was on was just beyond saving, and so they brought it down.
What are your favorite signs? Give us a call, 513-419-7100. You can also email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Todd, we've gone from signs painted on the sides of barns to billboards, and now we've got these digital signs that are all over the place. How effective do you think today's signs are as a medium of communicating? Signs still have their power?
They still have their power. What has happened is, if you think about the today, is that you talk about branding, okay? So a lot of the signs now are corporate logos, repeated branding. Branding is very strong. If you think of back in the 40s, 30s, 20s, a lot of the businesses were mom-and-pop businesses. So each mom-and-pop business had their own individual custom sign. With the advent of branding, the signs become more and more the same, looking and McDonald's wants to maintain its logo. A paint company wants to maintain its logo. So that's one of the big changes, is the repetitive logos, which works. I mean, it's branding works, but it kind of takes away from the custom feel of signage.
I love McDonald's signs back when they were neon. They were pretty spectacular. They're one of the coolest things out there.
And Bill, you've got a great big one of those at the Sign Museum.
Yeah, we actually have one of the single arch signs with the animated Speedy guy in the middle.
Okay.
It's from Huntsville, Alabama, 1963. The speedy guy goes back to the day before we had the concept of fast food. McDonald's coined the phrase speedy service system, which you can see on the sign. So they created this little mascot guy named Speedy. And he's, by animated, I mean his arms are going back and forth and his legs are going back. He's working very, very hard, Speedy is.
You know, this being Cincinnati, how many old beer signs have you collected for the museum?
We don't have a lot of beer signs, actually, because beer signs are so collectible.
So people don't want to give them up?
There, let's say I could buy two or three neon signs that were for a shoe store or a drug store or a grocery store compared to one beer sign because they're so collectible. We just scored, I guess that's the right word, a great collection of four, actually five, what we call reverse glass signs, where it's a light bulb sign with a glass face, and the glass is painted on the reverse side with whatever beer. One of the beer signs we have, the brewery that we just acquired, the brewery hasn't been around since the 1930s. So this was quite a coup to find these signs. We found them in we were contacted by a guy that was cleaning out a house in Pennsylvania in rural PA. So we do have some beer signs.
What are some of the signs that, besides the ones you're talking about, what are some of the other signs that you've recently added to the collection at the museum?
We just yesterday, a sign arrived. A woman from Pennsylvania, Philadelphia area. They had a small, we call POP sign, point of purchase, the sign inside a store for a dairy. Can't remember the name of it. Delwood Dairy. Just a local dairy store in Pennsylvania. She was cleaning out her house. It would have been her grandfather's. She didn't know what to do with the sign. One of the ways to maintain the memory of the family business is to have the sign come to the museum where it will always be on display.
And you also recently picked up, what was it, the Texas Wiener sign? That's pretty interesting.
I'm not sure about the Texas Wiener sign.
The Sherwin-Williams sign, too?
Well, we have just recently acquired a Sherwin-Williams sign. It's a neon sign with the cover the earth with paint, with the paint can tipped, yes.
How do you go about finding all these signs? What's the process like?
Well, originally, I went out and went after the signs. I leveraged the heck out of my years on the sign magazine, knowing sign companies around the country. As they took down old signs, my wish was that they would text me or email me a photo and say, before we haul this off to the scrapyard, if you want the sign, it's yours. Increasingly, people are calling us with signs, and I wish we had the resources to go after every sign that becomes available. But some of them are just so problematic because they're so big. People don't think about taking down a 30-foot sign and having to transport it. You have to think about overpasses on the interstate where you can only go 13 foot 6 inches high. You have to take apart the sign in order to transport it.
Like the old Arby's cowboy hats.
Like the old Arby's cowboy hat.
Yeah, some of those are pretty massive. So a lot of these signs, they're not coming to you in the greatest shape. What's the process for restoring them?
We default to not repainting signs. We have over 700 signs. We've actually only repainted five. I would like to have most of the signs inside the museum, where part of that sign story is how it weathered or patinaed. We do have one sign that has a bullet hole in it,
a real bullet hole
on the satellite.
Incidentally, it came from Compton, California, which if you know anything about Compton, you probably want to know why there's not more bullet holes in the sign. But that would be an extreme example. But that's one of the few signs we did repaint, but we obviously left the bullet hole as part of that sign story.
So why preserve these signs? Why care about preserving them?
Well, I think it's a celebration of the sign painting and the neon making craft. It harkens back to when things were handmade. There's a lot of interest in handmade. Now everything is computer cut on a router, inkjet printed. And the signs that we have, they were hand-painted, they were hand-lettered, the neon was bent by hand. It's just an appreciation of the hands-on crafts of sign making.
Todd, describe to me how the museum's set up. Are the signs grouped in any certain way by the type of sign, or is it just you walk into the museum and it's just like sign after sign after sign? Or chronological order? I mean, how are they set up?
Organized clutter would be
Would
be my description. You walk into the museum and we have a wall of letters stretching from 1900 to 1960. That traces the technologies and the materials used to make three-dimensional letters from that light bulb period I talked about to the neon period to the plastic period and everywhere in between. You turn the corner and we go through those three periods of electric signs, light bulbs, neon, and plastic. Just before that, there's a painted area where we talk about trade signs, as I mentioned. We talk about show cards. We talk about gold leaf. Then you turn the corner once again, and you come down to our what we call signs on Main Street. And the idea is, signs on Main Street is our grand finale, as I call it. The idea is the signs that you've seen mounted to the floor, mounted to the wall, hanging from the ceiling, are now put in context, mean put them on buildings. So we designed a whole Main Street of life-size storefronts where each storefront is designed backwards. It's designed around a sign we have. So we have a 1920 sign. We design and build a 1920s building to put that 1920 sign on. Then the windows of the storefronts actually become display cases for some of the smaller items in the museum's collection, every window having a theme unrelated to what that business is. So we have a 50s drugstore. The theme for its windows is not drugstore stuff, but sign painting. So you'll find sign painter kits, tools, and equipment, et cetera. So, yes, organized clutter.
With all these neon signs, all these lit signs, what's your electric bill like?
I get that question a lot. About 45 to 48,000 a year, about 4,000 a month, and not going down either.
But it's worth it, isn't it?
But it's worth it.
Well, that raises a question, if I may. Why are neon signs going away? Everyone seems to love neon signs, but you're seeing fewer and fewer.
Why are neon signs going away? Well, the advent of plastic in the post-war period, it was the advent of like the branding and corporate identity, whatever you want to call that. It was cost less money to produce plastic signs. You make a plastic face, it's backlit with fluorescent light bulbs, compared to having a tube bender bend the neon by hand. And you move on into the LEDs. Now part of that is the consumption, energy consumption. The only thing is that there's nothing like neon. Neon light, the light emitted from a neon or argon tube, you can't reproduce that. That emotional appeal of that neon light, it just can't. As long as neon's been around, there's been products just like neon, imitation neon. Everybody's has been trying to imitate neon since it was introduced in the late 20s. You just can't.
Do you like the new LED, LCD signs, or do they just not have the same warmth as neon?
They don't have the same appeal to me. There is a place for them, but it's just not like neon.
It's just basically television.
Do you have a lot of signs that, since you're in an old parachute factory, that have anything to do with war, World War II, World War I?
Actually, there weren't a lot of signs made during the war years, either World War I or World War II, because all the metal or whatever materials that you would have to make signs, all that went towards the war effort. So even the magazine I worked on had a tough time during the war years because there weren't a lot of advertisers advertising products that sign companies would use. Everything was about painting signs to support the war effort, war bonds, et cetera, et cetera.
So what's the most popular sign in the museum?
Probably have to make a top 10 list. Certainly, our big boy, our three-dimensional big boy is a Kodak moment if there ever was one.
Sounds like
The McDonald's sign that we've already mentioned is certainly one of the favorite signs. There's a spinning globe from Anaheim, California with 11 spikes in it, kind of like we call a Sputnik sign. That's always of a lot of interest. Some of the people that are more interested in the finer detail, like the gold leaf on glass signs. So there's something for everybody, I guess you might say.
The big genie outside.
The big genie outside is, yes, right at the entrance.
So what's the museum doing to celebrate its 10th anniversary?
Well, we've had 10 events over this year. The three events we have coming up in September is a big sign painters meet. It's the anniversary of the Letterheads, which is a grassroots movement to preserve the art of sign painting, gold leaf, hand lettering, etc. We'll probably have 300 or 400 sign painters at the museum. That's September 24th through 27th. That's a Thursday through Sunday. Saturday and Sunday, the museum will actually be open to the public from noon to 5, where people can come watch sign painters at work. In October, we're doing Signs and Steins, a tribute to Oktoberfest. And then in November, we've got our gift shop open for a holiday extravaganza.
Todd and Bill, thanks for joining us this afternoon. American Sign Museum founder Todd Swarmstead and WVXU reporter Bill Reinhardt. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You can find archives of our program at WVXU.org. Today's show was produced by Pete Reitmeier. Kevin Rawinski was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Science Friday, coming up next on 91.7 WVXU. Teachers often focus on students who are struggling to keep up with the rest of the class, but what about the kids who never seem to need any help? On the next Cincinnati Edition, we'll discuss the needs of gifted students. We'll also hear about the first African Americans in the U.S. space program, and in Focus on Technology, the debate about how much social media companies should monitor for terrorism. That's on Cincinnati Edition, Monday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.